Chapter 12. They had concluded that it was some clandestine amour, and out of curiosity had both slipped down to the house, and endeavored to find a position from which they could see into the room, but were unable to do so, and were about to go back to the street, when they heard a woman's voice cry out in great anger, colon, I know that you love her, and that you want to get rid of me, but you shall not do it. You murdered him, but you shall not murder me. I have all the evidence to convict you of murdering him. The archbishop will have it tomorrow. They shall hang you. Do you hear me? They shall hang you for this murder. That thereupon one of the policemen proposed that they should break into the house and see what was wrong, but the other had urged that it was only the usual lover's quarrel, and if they should interfere they would find nothing upon which a charge could be based, and would only be laughed at by the chief. That they had waited and listened for a time, but hearing nothing further had gone back to the street, and contented themselves with keeping a strict watch on the house. The people proved further that on Thursday evening Ninus and Croix had given the old Negro domestic a sum of money and dismissed her, with the instruction that she was not to return until sent for. The old woman testified that as he had gone directly to the house of her son, and later had discovered that as he had forgotten some articles of clothing which he needed, that thereupon as he had returned to the house, and had gone up the back way to her room, this was about 8 o'clock, that while there as he had heard Ninus and Croix's voice in great passion, and remembered that as he had used the words stated by the policeman, that these sudden, violent cries had frightened her greatly, and as he had bolted the door, and been afraid to leave the room, shortly thereafter, as he had heard heavy footsteps ascending the stairs, slowly and with great difficulty, as though someone were carrying a heavy burden, that therefore her fear had increased, and that as he had put out the light and hidden under the bed, she remembered hearing the footsteps moving about upstairs for many hours, how long she could not tell. Finally, about 4:30 in the morning, she crept out, opened the door, slipped downstairs, and ran out into the street. There she had found the policeman, and requested them to search the house. The two officers had gone to the house with the woman. As he had opened the door and they had just time to step back into the shadow when the prisoner entered. When arrested, Victor Ancona had screamed with terror, and cried out, it was no use, it was no use to do it. The chief of police had come to the house, and instituted a careful search. In the room below, from which the cries had come, he found a dress which was identified as belonging to Ninus and Croix, and which she was wearing when last seen by the domestic, about 6 o'clock that evening. This dress was covered with blood, and had a slit about 2 inches long in the left side of the bosom, into which the Mexican knife, found on the prisoner, fitted perfectly. These articles were introduced in evidence, and it was shown that the slit would be exactly over the heart of the wearer, and that such a wound would certainly result in death. There was much blood on one of the chairs, and on the floor. There was also blood on the prisoner's coat, and the leg of his trousers, and the heavy Mexican knife was also bloody. The blood was shown by the experts to be human blood. The body of the woman was not found, and the most rigid and tireless search failed to develop the slightest trace of the corpse, or the manner of its disposal. The body of the woman had disappeared as completely as though it had vanished into the air. When counsel announced that he had closed for the people, the judge turned and looked gravely down at Mason. He said, the evidence for the defense may now be introduced. Randolph Mason arose slowly, and faced the judge. If your honor please, he said, speaking slowly and distinctly, the defendant has no evidence to offer. He paused while a murmur of astonishment ran over the courtroom. But, if your honor please, he continued, I move that the jury be directed to find the prisoner not guilty. The crowd stirred. The counsel for the people smiled. The judge looked sharply at the speaker over his glasses. And what ground? He said curtly. On the ground, replied Mason, that the corpus delicti has not been proven. said the judge, for once losing his judicial gravity. Mason sat down abruptly. The senior counsel for the prosecution was on his feet in a moment. What? He said, the gentleman bases his motion on a failure to establish the corpus delicti? Does he jest, or has he forgotten the evidence? The term corpus delicti is technical, and means the body of the crime, or the substantial fact that a crime has been committed. Does anyone doubt it in this case? It is true that no one actually saw the prisoner kill the decedent, and that he has so successfully hidden the body that it has not been found, but the powerful chain of circumstances, clear and close linked, proving motive, the criminal agency, and the criminal act, is overwhelming. The victim in this case is on the eve of making a statement that would prove fatal to the prisoner. The night before the statement is to be made, he goes to her residence. They quarrel. Her voice is heard, raised high in the greatest passion, denouncing him, and charging that he is a murderer, that as he has the evidence, and will reveal it, that he shall be hanged, and that he shall not be rid of her. Here is the motive for the crime, clear as light. Are not the bloody knife, the bloody dress, the bloody clothes of the prisoner, unimpeachable witnesses to the criminal act? The criminal agency of the prisoner has not the shadow of a possibility to obscure it. His motive is gigantic. The blood on him, and his despair when arrested, cry murder, murder, apostrophe with a thousand tongues. Men may lie, but circumstances cannot. The thousand hopes and fears and passions of men may delude, or bias the witness. Yet it is beyond the human mind to conceive that a clear, complete chain of concatenated circumstances can be in error. Hence it is that the greatest jurists have declared that such evidence, being rarely liable to delusion or fraud, is safest and most powerful. The machinery of human justice cannot guard against the remote and improbable doubt. The inference is persistent in the affairs of men. It is the only means by which the human mind reaches the truth. If you forbid the jury to exercise it, you bid them work after first striking off their hands. Rule out the irresistible inference, and the end of justice has come in this land, and you may as well leave the spider to weave his web through the abandoned courtroom. The attorney stopped, looked down at Mason with a pompous sneer, and retired to his place at the table. The judge sat thoughtful and motionless. The jurymen leaned forward in their seats. If your honor please, said Mason, rising, this is a matter of law, plain, clear, and so well settled in the state of New York, that even counsel for the people should know it. The question before your honor is simple. If the corpus delicti, the body of the crime, has been proven, as required by the laws of the Commonwealth, then this case should go to the jury. If not, then it is the duty of this court to direct the jury to find the prisoner not guilty. There is here no room for judicial discretion. Your Honor has but to recall and apply the rigid rule announced by our courts prescribing distinctly how the corpus delicti in murder must be proven. The prisoner here stands charged with the highest crime. The law demands, first, that the crime, as a fact, be established. The fact that the victim is indeed dead must first be made certain, before anyone can be convicted for her killing, because, so long as there remains the remotest doubt as to the death, there can be no certainty as to the criminal agent, although the circumstantial evidence indicating the guilt of the accused may be positive, complete, and utterly irresistible. In murder, the corpus delicti, or body of the crime, is composed of two elements. Death, as a result. The criminal agency of another as the means. It is the fixed and immutable law of this state, laid down in the leading case of Roloff v. the people, and binding upon this court, that both components of the corpus delicti shall not be established by circumstantial evidence. There must be direct proof of one or the other of these two component elements of the corpus delicti. If one is proven by direct evidence, the other may be presumed. but both shall not be presumed from circumstances, no matter how powerful, how cogent, or how completely overwhelming the circumstances may be. In other words, no man can be convicted of murder in the state of New York unless the body of the victim be found and identified, or there be direct proof that the prisoner did some act adequate to produce death, and did it in such a manner as to account for the disappearance of the body. The face of the judge cleared and grew hard. The members of the bar were attentive and alert. They were beginning to see the legal escape open up. The audience were puzzled. They did not yet understand. Mason turned to the counsel for the people. His ugly face was bitter with contempt. For 3 days, he said, I have been tortured by this useless and expensive farce. If counsel for the people had been other than play actors, they would have known in the beginning that Victor Ancona could not be convicted for murder unless he were confronted in this courtroom with a living witness who had looked into the dead face of Nina San Croix, or, if not that, a living witness who had seen him drive the dagger into her bosom. I care not if the circumstantial evidence in this case were so strong and irresistible as to be overpowering. If the judge on the bench, if the jury, if every man within sound of my voice were convinced of the guilt of the prisoner to the degree of certainty that is absolute, if the circumstantial evidence left in the mind no shadow of the remotest improbable doubt, yet, in the absence of the eyewitness, this prisoner cannot be punished, and this court must compel the jury to acquit him. The audience now understood, and they were dumbfounded. Surely this was not the law. They had been taught that the law was common sense, and this was anything else. Mason saw it all, and grinned. In its tenderness, he sneered, the law shields the innocent. The good law of New York reaches out its hand, and lifts the prisoner out of the clutches of the fierce jury that would hang him. Mason sat down. The room was silent. The jurymen looked at each other in amazement. The counsel for the people arose. His face was white with anger and incredulous. Your Honor, he said, this doctrine is monstrous. Can it be said that, in order to evade punishment, the murderer has only to either destroy the body of the victim or sink it into the sea? Then, if he is not seen to kill, the law is powerless, and the murderer can snap his finger in the face of retributive justice. If this is the law, then the law for the highest crime is a dead letter. The great commonwealth winks at murder, and invites every man to kill his enemy, provided he kill him in secret and hide him. I repeat, Your Honor, the man's voice was now loud and angry, and rang through the courtroom, that this doctrine is monstrous. So said Best, and Story, and many another, muttered Mason, and the law remained. The court, said the judge, abruptly, desires no further argument. The counsel for the people resumed his seat. His face lighted up with triumph. The court was going to sustain him. The judge turned and looked down at the jury. He was grave, and spoke with deliberate emphasis. Gentlemen of the jury, he said, the rule of Lord Hale obtains in this state, and is binding upon me. It is the law as stated by counsel for the prisoner, that to warrant conviction of murder there must be direct proof either of the death, as of the finding and identification of the corpse, or of criminal violence adequate to produce death, and exerted in such a manner as to account for the disappearance of the body, and it is only when there is direct proof of the one that the other can be established by circumstantial evidence. This is the law, and cannot now be departed from. I do not presume to explain its wisdom. Chief Justice Johnson has observed, in the leading case, that it may have its probable foundation in the idea that where direct proof is absent, as to both the fact of the death, and of criminal violence capable of producing death, no evidence can rise to the degree of moral certainty that the individual is dead by criminal intervention, or even lead by direct inference to this result, and that, where the fact of death is not certainly ascertained, All inculpatory circumstantial evidence wants the key necessary for its satisfactory interpretation, and cannot be depended on to furnish more than probable results. It may be, also, that such a rule has some reference to the dangerous possibility that a general preconception of guilt, or a general excitement of popular feeling, may creep in to supply the place of evidence, if, upon other than direct proof of death or a cause of death, a jury are permitted to pronounce a prisoner guilty. In this case the body has not been found, and there is no direct proof of criminal agency on the part of the prisoner, although the chain of circumstantial evidence is complete and irresistible in the highest degree. Nevertheless, it is all circumstantial evidence, and under the laws of New York the prisoner cannot be punished. I have no right of discretion. The law does not permit a conviction in this case, although every one of us may be morally certain of the prisoner's guilt. I am, therefore, gentlemen of the jury, compelled to direct you to find the prisoner not guilty. Judge, interrupted the foreman, jumping up in the box, we cannot find that verdict under our oath. We know that this man is guilty. Sir, said the judge, this is a matter of law in which the wishes of the jury cannot be considered. The clerk will write a verdict of not guilty, which you, as foreman, will sign. The spectators broke out into a threatening murmur that began to grow and gather volume. The judge rapped on his desk, and ordered the bailiffs promptly to suppress any demonstration on the part of the audience. Then he directed the foreman to sign the verdict prepared by the clerk. When this was done he turned to Victor Ancona. His face was hard, and there was a cold glitter in his eyes. Prisoner at the bar, he said, you have been put to trial before this tribunal on a charge of cold-blooded and atrocious murder. The evidence produced against you was of such powerful and overwhelming character that it seems to have left no doubt in the minds of the jury, nor indeed in the mind of any person present in this courtroom. Had the question of your guilt been submitted to these 12 arbiters, a conviction would certainly have resulted, and the death penalty would have been imposed. But the law, rigid, passionless, even-eyed, has thrust in between you and the wrath of your fellows, and saved you from it. I do not cry out against the impotency of the law. It is perhaps as wise as imperfect humanity could make it. I deplore, rather, the genius of evil men who, by cunning design, are enabled to slip through the fingers of this law. I have no word of censure or admonition for you, Victor Ancona. The law of New York compels me to acquit you. I am only its mouthpiece, with my individual wishes throttled. I speak only those things which the law directs I shall speak. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.